Track 3.
Come, called Nick Berg. As Vin Baker entered, it could be seen that his overalls were pristine blue. But the bandage around his head was smeared with engine grease, and he'd recovered all the bounce and swagger that Nick had banged out of him against the engine room windows. Jesus, he said. I heard you just flipped. I hear you blew your mind and jumped overboard. And when they fished you out, you up and went open form on a bomber that's beating herself to death on Cape Alarm. I'll explain it to you, offered Nick solemnly. Only I don't know enough words of one syllable. The chief engineer grinned wickedly at that, and Nick went on quickly, Just believe me when I tell you that I'm playing with someone else's chips. I'm not risking anything I haven't lost already. That's good business, the Australian agreed handsomely, and helped himself to one of Nick's precious cheroots. Your share of 12.5% of daily hire is peanuts and apple jelly, Nick went on. Too right, Vin Baker agreed, and hoisted at his waistline with his elbows. But if we snatch Golden Adventurer, and if we can plug her and pump her out, and if we can keep her afloat for 3,000 miles, there will be a couple of big M's, and that's beef and potatoes. You know something? Vin Baker grunted. For a pommy, I'm beginning to like the sound of your voice. He said it reluctantly and shook his head, as if he didn't really believe it. All I want you for now, Nick told him, are your plans for getting power onto Golden Adventurer's pumps and anchor winch. If she's up on the beach, we'll have to kedge her off, and we won't have much time. Kedging off was the technique of using a ship's own anchor and power winch to assist the pull of the tug in dragging her off a stranding. Vin Baker waved the cheroot airily. Don't worry about that. I'm here. At that moment, the trog put his head through the doorway again, this time without knocking. I have an urgent and personal for you, Skipper. He brandished the telex flimsy like a royal flush in spades. Nick glanced through it once, then read it aloud. Master of Warlock from Christie, Maine. Your offer, Lloyd's open form, no cure, no pay, accepted. Stop. You are hereby appointed Maine salvage contractor for wreck of Golden Adventurer. Ends. Nick grinned with that rare, wide, irresistible flash of very white teeth. And so, gentlemen, it looks as though we are still in business. But the devil knows for just how much longer. Warlock rounded the headland, where the three black pillars of serpentine rock stood into a lazy green sea, across which low, oily swells marched in orderly ranks, to push in gently against the black cliffs. They came round to the sudden vista of the wide, ice-choked bay. The abandoned hulk of Golden Adventurer was so majestic, so tall and beautiful, that not even the savage mountains could belittle her. She looked like an illustration from a child's book of fairy tales, a lovely ice ship, glistening and glittering in the yellow sunlight. She's a beauty, whispered the chief engineer. And his voice captured the sorrow they all felt for a great ship in mortal distress. To every single man on the bridge of Warlock, a ship was a living thing, for which at best they could feel love and admiration. Even the dirtiest old tramp roused a grudging affection. But Golden Adventurer was like a lovely woman. She was something rare and special, and all of them felt it. For Nick Berg, the bond was much more deeply felt. She was a child of his inspiration. He had watched her lines take shape on the naval architect's drawing board. He had seen her keel laid, and her bare skeleton fleshed out with lovingly worked steel. and he'd watched the woman who had once been his wife speak the blessing and then smash the bottle against her bows, laughing in the sunlight while the wine spurted and frothed. She was his ship, and now, as he would never have believed possible, his destiny depended upon her. He looked away from her at last to where La Mouette waited in the mouth of the bay at the edge of the ice. In contrast to the liner, she was small and squat and ugly, like a wrestler with all the weight in his shoulders. Greasy black smoke rose straight into the pale sky from her single stack, and her hull seemed to be painted the same greasy black. Through his glasses, Nick saw the sudden bustle of activity on her bridge as Warlock burst into view. The headland would have blanketed Lamouette's radar, and, with Nick's strict radio silence, this would be the first that Jules de Voisin knew of Warlock's presence. Nick could imagine the consternation on her navigation bridge, and he noted wryly that Jules de Voisin had not even gone through the motions of putting a line onto Golden Adventurer. He must have been completely sure of himself, of his unopposed presence. In maritime law, a line onto a prize's hull bestowed certain rights, and Jules should have made the gesture. "Get Lamouette in clear," he instructed, and picked up the hand microphone as the Trog nodded to him. "Salut, Jules. Ça va? You pot-bellied little pirate. Haven't they caught and hung you yet?" Nick asked kindly in French. And there was a long, disbelieving silence on Channel 16 before the fruity Gallic tones boomed from the overhead speaker. "Admiral James Bond, I think." And Jules chuckled, but unconvincingly. "Is that a battleship or a floating whorehouse? You always were a fancy boy, Nicholas. But what kept you so long? I expected to get a better run for my money." "Three things you taught me, mon brave. The first was to take nothing for granted. The second was to keep your big yap shut tight when running for a prize. And the third was to put a line on it when you get there. You've broken your own rules, Jules." "The line is nothing. I am arrived." "And I, old friend, am arrived also. But the difference is that I am Christie's main contractor." "Tu rigoles. You are joking." Jules was shocked. "I heard nothing of this." "I am not joking," Nick told him. "My James Bond equipment lets me talk in private. But go ahead. Call Christie Main and ask them. And while you're doing it, move that dirty old greaser of yours out of the way. I've got work to do." Nick tossed the microphone back to the Trog. "Tape everything he sends," he instructed. And then to David Allen. "We are going to smash up that ice before it grabs too tight a hold on Golden Adventurer. Put your best man on the wheel." Nick was a man transformed, no longer the brooding, moody recluse, agonizing over each decision, uncertain of himself, and reacting to each check with frustrated and undirected anger. "When he starts moving, he really burns it up," thought David Allen, as he listened to Nick on the engine-roomed intercom. "I want flank power on both, Chief. We're going to break ice, and I want you in full immersion with helmet. We're going on board her to take a peek at her engine room." He swung back to David Allen. "Number one, you can stand by to take command." The man of action, glorying in the end to inactivity. He almost seemed to dance upon his feet, like a fighter at the first bell. "Tell Angel I want a hot meal for us before we go into the cold, plenty of sugar in it." "I'll ask the steward," said David. "Angel is no good at the moment. He's playing dolls with the lass you pulled out the water. God, he'll be dressing her up and wheeling her around in a pram." "You tell Angel I want food and good food," growled Nick, and turned away to the window to study the ice that blocked the bay. "Or I'll go down personally and kick his backside." "He'll probably enjoy that," muttered David. and Nick rounded on him. How many times have you checked out the salvage gear since we left Cape Town? 4 times. Make it 5. Do it again. I want all the diesel auxiliaries started and run up, then shut down for freezing and rigged to be swung out. I want to have power on Adventurer by noon tomorrow. Sir. But before he could go, Nick asked, what is the barometric reading? I don't know. From now on, until the end of this salvage, you will know, at any given moment, the exact pressure, and you will inform me immediately any variation over 1 millibar. Reading is 1018. David checked hastily. It's too high, said Nick, and it's too bloody calm. Watch it. We're going to have a pressure bounce. Watch it like an Eagle Scout. Sir, I thought I asked you to check the gear. The trog called out, Christy Main has just called Lamouette and confirmed that we are the main contractor. But Levoisin has accepted daily hire to pick up a full load of survivors from Shackleton Bay and ferry them to Cape Town. Now he wants to speak to you again. Tell him I'm busy. Nick did not take his intention from the ice-packed bay. Then he changed his mind. No, I'll talk to him. He took the hand microphone. Jules, you don't play fair, Nicholas. You go behind the back of an old friend, a man who loves you like a brother. I'm a busy man. Do you truly call to tell that? I think you made a mistake, Nicholas. I think you're crazy to go Lloyd's open on this one. That ship is stuck fast, and the weather. Did you read the Met from Gough Island? You got yourself a screaming bastard there, Nicholas. You listen to an old man. Jules, I've got 22,000 horses running for me. I still think you made a mistake, Nicholas. I think you're going to burn more than just your fingers. Au revoir, Jules. Come and watch me in the awards court. I still think that's a whorehouse, not a tug, you are sailing. You can send over a couple of blondes and a bottle of wine. Goodbye, Jules. Good luck, mon vieux. Hey, Jules. You say good luck, and it's the worst possible luck. You taught me that. Oui, I know. Then, good luck to you also, Jules. For a minute, Nick looked after the departing tug. It waddled away over the oily swells, small and fat-bottomed and cheeky, for all the world like its master. And yet, there was something dejected and crestfallen about her going. He felt a prick of affection for the little Frenchman. He had been a true and good friend as well as a teacher, and Nick felt his triumph softening to regret. He crushed it down ruthlessly. It had been a straight, hard, but fair run, and Jules had been careless. Long ago, Nick had taught himself that anybody in opposition was an enemy, to be hated and beaten, and when you'd done so, you despised them. You did not feel compassion. It weakened your own resolve. He could not quite bring himself to despise Jules Levoisin. The Frenchman would bounce back, probably snatching the next job from out of under Nick's nose. And anyway, he had the lucrative contract to ferry the survivors from Shackleton Bay. It would pay the costs of his long run southwards and leave some useful change over. Nick's own dilemma was not as easily resolved. He put Jules Levoisin out of his mind, turning away before the French tug had rounded the headland, and he studied the ice-choked bay before him with narrow eyes and a growing feeling of concern. Jules had been right. This was going to be a screaming bastard of a job. The high seas that had thrown Golden Adventurer ashore had been made even higher by the equinoctial spring tides. Both had now abated, and she was fast. The liner's hull had swung also, so she was not aligned neatly at right angles to the beach. Warlock would not be able to throw a straight pull onto her. She would have to drag her sideways. Nick could see that now as he closed. Still closer, he could see how the heavy steel hull, half filled with water, had burrowed itself into the yielding shingle. She would stick like toffee to a baby's blanket. Then he looked at the ice. It was not only brash and pancake ice, but there were big chunks, bergy bits, from rotten and weathered icebergs, which the wind had driven into the bay like a sheepdog with his flock. The plunging temperatures had welded this mass of ice into a hole. Like a monstrous octopus, it was wrapping thick, glistening tentacles around Adventurer's stern. The ice had not yet had sufficient time to become impenetrable, and Warlock's bows were ice-strengthened for just such an emergency. Yet, Nick knew enough not to underestimate the hardness of ice. White ice is soft ice, was the old adage. And yet, here there were big lumps and hummocks of green and striated glacial ice in the mass, like fat plums in a pudding, any one of which could punch a hole through Warlock's hull. Nick grimaced at the thought of having to send Jules Le Voisin a mayday. He spoke to the helmsman quietly. Starboard five, midships, lining Warlock up for a fracture line in the ice pack. It was vital to come in at a right angle, to take the ice fully on the stem. A glancing blow could throw the bows off line and bring the vulnerable hull in contact with razor ice. Stand by engine room, he alerted them, and Warlock bore down on the ice at a full 10 knots, and Nick judged the moment of impact finally. Half a ship's length clear, he gave a crisp order. Both half back. Warlock checked, going up onto the ice as she decelerated, but still with a horrid, rasping roar that echoed through the ship. Her bows rose, riding up over the ice. It gave with a rending crackle, huge slabs of ice upending and tumbling together. Both full back. The huge twin propellers changed their pitch smoothly into reverse thrust, and the wash boiled into the broken ice, sweeping it clear as Warlock drew back into open water. And Nick steadied her and lined her up again. Both ahead full. Warlock charged forward, checking at the last moment, and again thick slabs of white ice broke away and grated along the ship's side. Nick swung her stern, first starboard, then port, deftly using the twin screws to wash the broken ice free. Then he pulled Warlock out and lined her up again. Butting and smashing and pivoting, Warlock worked her way deeper into the bay, opening a spreading web of cracks across the white sheet of ice. David Allen was breathless as he burst onto the bridge. All gear checked and ready, sir. Take her, said Nick. She's broken it up now. Just keep it stirred up. He wanted to add a warning that the big variable pitch propellers were Warlock's most vulnerable part. But he had a high enough opinion now of his mate's ability, so he went on instead. I'm going now to kit up. Vin Baker was in the aft salvage hold ahead of him. He'd already half-finished the tray of rich food. An angel hovered over him. But as Nick came down the steel ladder, he lifted the cover off another steaming tray. It's good, said Nick, although he could hardly force himself to swallow. The nerves in his stomach were bunched up too tightly. Yet food was one of the best defenses against the cold. Samantha wants to talk to you, Skip. Who the hell is Samantha? The girl. She wants to thank you. Use your head, Angel. Can't you see I have other things on my mind? Nick was already putting on the rubber immersion suit over a full-length woolen undersuit. He needed the assistance of a seaman to enter the opening in the chest of the suit. He had already forgotten about the girl as they closed the chest opening of the suit with a double ring seal. And then, over the watertight booties and mittens, went another full suit of polyurethane. Nick and Vin Baker looked like a pair of fat Michelin men. As their dressers helped them into the full helmets with wraparound visors, built-in radio microphones, and breathing valves. "Okay, Chief?" Nick asked, and Vin Baker's voice squawked too loudly into his headphones. "Clear to roll." Nick adjusted the volume, and then shrugged into the oxygen rebreathing set. They were not going deeper than 30 feet, so Nick had decided to use oxygen rather than the bulky steel compressed air cylinders. "Let's go," he said, and waddled to the ladder. The Zodiac 16-foot inflatable dinghy swung overboard with the four of them in it. Two divers and two picked seamen to handle the boat. Vin pushed one of them aside and primed the outboard himself. "Come on, beauty," he told it sternly, and the big Johnson Seahorse fired at the first kick. Gingerly, they began to feel their way through an open lead in the ice, with the two seamen poling away small sharp pieces that would have ripped the fabric of the Zodiac. In Nick's radio headset, David Allen's voice spoke suddenly. "Captain, this is the first officer. Barometric pressure is 1021. It looks like it's going through the roof." The pressure was bouncing, as Nick had predicted. What goes up must come down, and the higher she goes, the lower she falls. Jules Levoisin had warned him it was going to be a screamer. "Did you read the last met from Gough Island?" "They have 1005 falling, and the wind at 320 degrees and 35 knots. "Lovely," said Nick. "We've got a big blow coming." And through the visor of his helmet, he looked up at the pale and beautiful sun. It was not bright enough to pain the eye, and now it wore a fine golden halo, like the head of a saint in a medieval painting. "Skipper, this is as close as we can get," Vin Baker told him, and slipped the motor into neutral. The Zodiac coasted gently into a small open pool in the ice pack, 50 yards from Golden Adventurer's stern. A solid sheet of compacted ice separated them, and Nick studied it carefully. He had not taken the chance of working Warlock in closer until he could get a look at the bottom here. He wanted to know what depth of water he had to maneuver in, and if there were hidden snags, jagged rock to rip through the Warlock's hull, or flat shingle on which he could risk a bump. He wanted to know the slope of the bottom, and if there was good holding for his ground tackle, but most of all, he wanted to inspect the underwater damage to Golden Adventurer's hull. "Okay, Chief," he asked, and Vin Baker grinned at him through the visor. "Hey, I just remembered. My mummy told me not to get my feet wet. I'm going home." Nick knew just how he felt. There was thick sheet ice between them. An adventurer, they had got to go down and swim below it. God alone knew what currents were running under the ice and what visibility was like down there. A man in trouble could not surface immediately, but must find his way back to open water. Nick felt a claustrophobic tightening of his belly muscles, and he worked swiftly, checking out his gear, cracking the valve on his oxygen flask, to inflate the breathing bag, checking the compass and the Rolex Oyster on his wrist, and clipping his buddy line onto the Zodiac, a line to return along, like Theseus in the labyrinth of the Minotaur. "Let's go," he said, and flipped backwards into the water. The cold struck through the multiple layers of rubber and cloth and polyurethane almost instantly, and Nick waited only for the chief engineer to break through the surface beside him in a cloud of swirling silver bubbles.
"God!"
Vin Baker's voice was distorted by the earphones. "It's cold enough to crack the gooseberries off a plaster saint." Paying out the line behind him, Nick sank down into the hazy green depths, looking for bottom. It came up dimly, heavy shingle and pebble, and he checked his depth gauge, almost 6 fathoms, and he moved in towards the beach. The light from the surface was filtered through thick ice, green and ghostly in the icy depths, and Nick felt unreasonable panic stirring deep in him. He tried to thrust it aside and concentrate on the job, but it flickered there, ready to burst into flame. There was a current working under the ice, churning the sediment so that the visibility was further reduced, and they had to fin hard to make headway across the bottom, always with the hostile ceiling of somber green ice above them, cutting them off from the real world. Suddenly, the Golden Adventurous hull loomed ahead of them, the twin propellers glinting like gigantic bronze wings in the gloom. They moved in within arm's length of the steel hull and swam slowly along it. It was like flying along the outer wall of a tall apartment block, a sheer cliff of riveted steel plate, but the hull was moving. The Golden Adventurer was hogging on the bottom, the stern dipping and swaying to the pulse of the sea, the heaving groundswell that came in under the ice. Her stern bumped heavily on the pebbly bottom, like a great hammer beating time to the ocean. Nick knew that she was settling herself in. Every hour now was making his task more difficult, and he drove harder with his swim fins, pulling slightly ahead of Vin Baker. He knew exactly where to look for the damage. Riley had reported it in minute detail to Christy Main, but he came across it without warning. It looked as though a monstrous axe had been swung horizontally at the hull, a clean slash, the shape of an elongated teardrop. The metal around it had been depressed, and the paint smeared away so that the steel gleamed as though it had been scoured and polished. At its widest, the lips of the 15-foot rent gaped open by 3 feet or a little more, and it breathed like a living mouth. For the force of the groundswell, pushing into the gap, built up pressure within the hull. Then, as the swell subsided, the trapped water was forcibly expelled, sucking it in and out with tremendous pressure. "It's a clean hull," Vin Baker's voice squawked harshly, "but it's too long to pump with cement." He was right, of course. Nick had seen that at once. Liquid cement would not plug that wicked gash. And anyway, there wasn't time to use cement, not with the weather coming. An idea began forming in his mind. "I'm going to penetrate." Nick made the decision aloud, and beside him, the chief was silent for long, incredulous seconds. Then he covered the edge of fear in his voice with, "Listen, Carver. Every time I've ever been into an orifice shaped like that, it's always meant big trouble. Reminds me of my first wife." "Cover for me," Nick interrupted him. "If I'm not out in 5 minutes..." "I'm coming with you," said the chief. "I've got to take a look at our engine room. This is as good a time as any." Nick did not argue with him. "I'll go first," he said, and tapped the chief's shoulder. "Do what I do." Nick hung 4 feet from the gash, finning to hold himself there against the current. He watched the swirl of water rushing into the opening, and then gushing out again in a rash of silver bubbles. Then, as she began to breathe again, he darted forward. The current caught him, and he was hurled at the gap, with only time to duck his helmeted head and cover the fragile oxygen bag on his chest with both arms. Raw steel snagged at his leg. There was no pain, but almost instantly he felt the leak of seawater into his suit. The cold stung like a razor cut, but he was through into the total darkness of the cavernous hull. He was flung into a tangle of steel piping, and he anchored himself with one arm and groped for the underwater lantern on his belt. "You okay?" The chief's voice boomed in his headphones. "Fine." Vin Baker's lantern glowed eerily in the dark waters ahead of him. "Work fast," instructed Nick. "I've got a tear in my suit." Each of them knew exactly what to do and where to go. Vin Baker swam first to the watertight bulkheads and checked all the seals. He was working in darkness in a totally unfamiliar engine room, but he went unerringly to the pump system and checked the valve settings. Then he rose to the surface, feeling his way up the massive blocks of the main engines. Nick was there ahead of him. The engine room was flooded almost to the deck above, and the surface was a thick, stinking scum of oil and diesel, in which floated a mass of loose articles, most of them undefinable. But in the beam of his lantern, Nick recognized a gumboot and a grease pot floating beside his head. The whole thick, stinking soup rose and fell and agitated with the push of the current through the rent. The lenses of their lanterns were smeared with the oily filth and threw grotesque shadows into the cavernous depths. But Nick could just make out the deck above him and the dark opening of the vertical ventilation shaft. He wiped the filth from his visor and saw what he wanted to see, and the cold was spreading up his leg. He asked brusquely, "Okay, Chief, let's get the hell out of here." There were sickening moments of panic when Nick thought they had lost the line to the opening. It had snagged and wrapped around a steam pipe. Nick freed it and then sank down to the glimmer of light through the gash. He judged his moment carefully. The return was more dangerous than the entry, for the raw, bright metal had been driven in by the ice, like the petals of a sunflower or the fangs in a shark's maw. He used the suck of water and shot through without a touch, turning and finning to wait for Vin Baker. The Australian came through in the next rush of water, but Nick saw him flicked sideways by the current, and he struck the jagged opening a touching blow. There was instantly a roaring rush of escaping oxygen from his breathing bag as the steel split it wide, and for a moment the chief was obscured in the silver cloud of gas that was his life's breath. "Oh, God, I'm snagged!" he shouted, clutching helplessly at his empty bag, plummeting sharply into the green depths of the drastic change in his buoyancy. The heavily loaded belt, around his waist, had been weighted to counter the flotation of the oxygen bag, and he went down like a gannet diving on a shoal of sardine. Nick saw instantly what was about to happen. The current had him. It was dragging him down under the hull, sucking him under that hammering steel bottom, where he would be crushed against the stony beach by 22,000 tons of pounding steel. Nick went head down, finning desperately to catch the swirling body, which tumbled like a leaf in high wind. He had a fleeting glimpse of Baker's face, contorted with terror and lack of breath, the glass visor of his helmet already swamping with ice water as the pressure spurted through the non-return valve. The chief's headset microphone squealed once and then went dead as the water shorted it out. "Drop your belt!" yelled Nick. But Baker did not respond. He had not heard, His headset had gone, and instead, he fought ineffectually in the swirling current, drawn inexorably down to brutal death. Nick got a hand to him and threw back with all his strength on his fins to check their downward plunge. But still they went down, and Nick's right hand was clumsy with cold and the double thickness of his mittens as he groped for the quick release on the chief's belt. He hit the rounded bottom of the great hull with his shoulder and felt them dragged under to where clouds of sediment blew like smoke from the working of the keel. Locked together, like a couple of waltzing dancers, they swung around and he saw the keel, like the blade of a guillotine, rise up high above them. He could not reach the chief's release toggle. There were only microseconds in which to go for his one other chance. He hit his own release, and the thick belt with 35 pounds of lead fell away from Nick's waist. With it went the buddy line that would guide them back to the waiting Zodiac, for it had been clipped into the back of the belt. The abrupt loss of weight checked their downward plunge, and fighting with all the strength of his legs, Nick was just able to hold them clear as the great keel as it came swinging downwards. Within 10 feet of them, steel struck stone with a force that rang in Nick's eardrum like a bronze gong. But he had an armlock on the chief's struggling body. And now at last, his right hand found the release toggle on the other man's belt. He hit it, and another 35 pounds of lead dropped away. They began to rise, up along the hogging steel hull, faster and faster as the oxygen in Nick's bag expanded with the release of pressure. Now their plight was every bit as desperate, for they were racing upward to a roof of solid ice with enough speed to break bone or crack a skull. Nick emptied his lungs, exhaling on a single continuous breath, and at the same time opened the valve to vent his bag, blowing away the precious life-giving gas in an attempt to check their rise. Yet still they went into the ice with a force that would have stunned them both, had Nick not twisted over and caught it on his shoulder and outflung arm. They were pinned there, under the ice, by the cork-like buoyancy of their rubber suits and the remaining gas in Nick's bag. With mild and detached surprise, Nick saw that the lower side of the ice pack was not a smooth sheet, but was worked into ridges and pinnacles, into weird flowing shapes like some abstract sculpture in pale green glass. It was only a fleeting moment that he looked at it, for beside him, Baker was drowning. His helmet was flooded with icy water, and his face was empurpled, and his mouth contorted into a horrible rictus. Already his movements were becoming spasmodic and uncoordinated as he struggled for breath. Nick realized that haste would kill them both now. He had to work fast, but deliberately, and he held Baker to him as he cracked the valve of his steel oxygen bottle, reinflating his chest bag. With his right hand, he began to unscrew the breathing pipe connection into the side of Baker's helmet. It was slow, too slow. He needed touch for this delicate work. He thought, this could cost me my right hand. And he stripped off the thick mitten in a single angry gesture. Now he could feel, for the few seconds, until the cold paralyzed his fingers. The connection came free, and while he worked, Nick was pumping his lungs like a bellows, hyperventilating, washing his blood with pure oxygen until he felt lightheaded and dizzy. One last sweet breath, and then he unscrewed his own hose connection. Icy water flooded through the valve, but he held his head at an angle to trap oxygen in the top of his helmet, keeping his nose and eyes clear. And he re-screwed his own hose into Baker's helmet with fingers that no longer had feeling. He held the chief's body close to his chest, embracing like lovers, and he cracked the last of the oxygen from his bottle. There was just sufficient pressure of gas left to expunge the water from Baker's helmet. It blew with an explosive hiss through the valve, and Nick watched carefully with his face only inches from Baker's. The chief was choking and coughing, gulping and gasping at the rush of cold oxygen, his eyes watery and unseeing, his spectacles blown awry and the lenses obscured by seawater. But then Nick felt his chest begin to swell and subside. Baker was breathing again. "Which is more than I am doing," Nick thought grimly. And then suddenly he realized for the first time that he had lost the guideline with his weight belt. He did not know in which direction was the shore, nor which way to swim to reach the Zodiac. He was utterly disorientated, and desperately he peered through his half-flooded visor for sight of the Golden Adventurer's hull to align himself. She was not there, gone in the misty green gloom, and he felt the first heave of his lungs as they demanded air. And as he denied his body the driving need to breathe, he felt the fear that had flickered deep within him flare up into true terror, swiftly becoming cold, driving panic. A suicidal urge to tear at the green ice roof of this watery tomb almost overwhelmed him. He wanted to try and rip his way through it with bare, freezing hands to reach the precious air. Then, just before panic completely obliterated his reason, he remembered the compass on his wrist. Even then, his brain was sluggish, beginning to starve for oxygen, and it took precious seconds working out the reciprocal of his original bearing. As he leaned forward to read the compass, more seawater spurted into his helmet, spiking needles of icy cold agony into the sinuses of his cheeks and forehead, making the teeth ache in his jaws, so he gasped involuntarily and immediately choked. Still holding Baker to him, linked by the thick black umbilical cord of his oxygen hose, Nick began to swim out on the reciprocal compass heading. Immediately, his lungs began to pump, convulsing in involuntary spasms, like those of childbirth, craving air, and he swam on. With his head thrown back slightly, he saw that the sheet of ice moved slowly above him. At times, when the current held them, it moved not at all, and it required all his self-control to keep finning doggedly. Then, the current relaxed its grip, and they moved forward again, but achingly slowly. He had time then to realize how exquisitely beautiful was the ice roof, translucent, wondrously carved and sculptured. And suddenly, he remembered standing hand in hand with Chantal beneath the arched roof of the Chartres Cathedral, staring up in awe. The pain in his chest subsided, the need to breathe passed, but he did not recognize that as the sign of mortal danger, nor the images that formed before his eyes as the fantasy of a brain deprived of oxygen and slowly dying. Chantal's face was before him then, glowing hair soft and thick and glossy as a butterfly's wing. Huge, dark eyes, and that wide mouth, so full of the promise of delight and warmth and love. "I loved you," he thought. "I really loved you." And the image changed. He saw again the incredible slippery explosive liquid burst with which his son was born, heard the first querulous cry as he dangled pink and wet and hairless from the rubber-gloved hand, and felt again the soul-consuming wonder and joy. A drowning man. Nick recognized at last what was happening to him. He knew then he was dying, but the panic had passed, as the cold had passed also, and the terror. He swam on, dreamlike, into the green mists. Then he realized that his own legs were no longer moving. He lay relaxed, not breathing, not feeling, and it was Baker's body that was thrusting and working against him. Nick peered into the glass visor, still only inches from his eyes, and he saw that Baker's face was set and determined. He was gulping the pure sweet oxygen and gaining strength with each breath, driving on strongly.
"You beauty," whispered Nick dreamily,
and felt the water shoot into his throat, but there was no pain. Another image formed before him. An Arrowhead class yacht with spinnaker set, running free across a bright Mediterranean sea, and his son at the tiller, the dense tumble of curls that covered his small, neat head fluttering in the wind, and the same velvety dark eyes as his mother's in the sun-tanned oval of his face as he laughed.
"Don't let her run by the lee, Peter!" Nicholas wanted to shout to his son, but the image faded into blackness. He thought for a moment that he had passed into unconsciousness. But then he realized suddenly that it was the black rubber bottom of the Zodiac only inches from his eyes, and that the rough hands that dragged him upwards, lifting him and tearing loose the fastening of his helmet, were not part of the fantasy. Propped against the pillowed gunwale of the Zodiac, held by the two boatmen from falling backwards, the first breaths of sub-zero air were too rich for his starved lungs, and Nick coughed and vomited weakly down the front of his suit. Nick came out of the shower cabinet. The cabin was thick with steam, and his body glowed dull, angry red from the almost boiling water. He wrapped the towel around his waist as he stepped through into his night cabin. Baker slouched in the armchair at the foot of his bunk. He wore fresh overalls. His hair stood up in little damp spikes around the shaven spot where Angel's cat-gut stitches still held the scabbed wound closed. One of the side frames of his spectacles had snapped during those desperate minutes below Golden Adventurer's stern, and Baker had repaired it with black insulating tape. He held two glasses in his left hand and a big, flat, brown bottle of liquor in the other. He poured two heavy slugs into the glasses as Nick paused in the bathroom door, and the sweet, rich aroma smelled like the sugarcane fields of northern Queensland. Baker passed a glass to Nick, and then showed him the bottle's yellow label. "Bundaberg rum," he announced. "The dinky-dye stuff, sport." Nick recognized both the offer of liquor and the salutation as probably the highest accolade the chief would ever give another human being. Nick sniffed the dark honey-brown liquor, and then took it in a single toss, swirled it once around his mouth, swallowed, shuddered like a spaniel shaking off water droplets, exhaled harshly and said, "It's still the finest rum in the world." Dutifully, he said what was expected of him and held out his glass. "The mate asked me to give you a message," said Baker, as he poured another shot for each of them. "Glass hit 1035. And now it's diving like a dingo into its hull. Back to 0120 already. It's gonna blow. Is it ever gonna blow?" They regarded each other over the rims of the glasses. "We've wasted almost 2 hours, beauty," Nick told him. And Baker blinked at the unlikely name, then grinned crookedly as he accepted it. "How are you going to plug that hull?" "I've got 10 men at work already. We're going to father a sail into a collision mat." Baker blinked again, then shook his head in disbelief. "That's hornblower stuff." "The Witch of Endor," Nick agreed. "So you can read." "You haven't got pressure to drive it home," Baker objected. The trapped air from the engine room will blow it out. I'm going to run a wire down the ventilation shaft of the engine room and out through the gash. We'll fix the collision mat outside the hull and winch it home with the wire. Baker stared at him for 5 seconds while he examined the proposition. A sail was fathered by threading the thick canvas with thousands of strands of unraveled oakum until it resembled a huge, shaggy doormat. When this was placed over an aperture below a ship's waterline, the pressure of water forced it into the hole, and the water swelled the mass of fiber until it formed an almost watertight plug. However, in Golden Adventurer's case, the damage was extensive, and as the hull was already flooded, there was no pressure differential to drive home the plug. Nick proposed to beat that by using an internal wire to haul the plug into the gash. It might work. Beauty Baker was non-committal. Nick took the second rum at a gulp, dropped the towel, and reached for his working gear laid out on the bunk. "Let's get power on her before the blow hits us," he suggested mildly. And Baker lumbered to his feet and stuffed the Bundaberg bottle into his back pocket. "Listen, sport," he said, "all that guff about you being a pommy, don't take it too seriously." "I won't," said Nick. "Actually, I was born and educated in Blighty, but my father's an American, so that makes me one also." "Christ!" Beauty hitched disgustedly at his waist with both elbows. "If there's anything worse than a bloody pom, it's a goddamned Yank." Now that Nick was certain that the bottom of the bay was clean and free of underwater snags, he handled Warlock boldly, but with a delicately skillful touch, which David Allen watched with awe. Like a fighting cock, the Warlock attacked the thicker ice line along the shore, smashing free huge lumps and slabs, then washing them clear with the propellers, giving herself space to work about Golden Adventurer's stern. The ominous calm of both sea and air made the work easier, although the vicious little current working below Adventurer's stern complicated the transfer of the big alternator. Nick had two Yokohama fenders slung from Warlock's side, and the bloated plastic balloons cushioned the contact of steel against steel as Nick laid Warlock alongside the stranded liner, holding her there with delicate adjustments of power and rudder and screw pitch. Beauty Baker and his working party, swaddled in heavy Antarctic gear, were already up on the catwalk of Warlock's forward gantry, 70 feet above the bridge and overlooking Adventurer's sharply canted deck. As Nick nudged Warlock in, they dropped the steel boarding ladder over the gap between the two ships, and Beauty led them across in single file, like a troop of monkeys across the limb of a forest tree. "All across," the third officer confirmed for Nick, and then added, "Glass has dropped again, sir, down to 1005. "Very well." Nick drew Warlock gently away from the liner's stern and held her 50 feet off. Only then did he flick his eyes up at the sky. The midnight sun had turned to a malevolent jaundiced yellow, while the sun itself was a ball of dark satanic red above the peaks of Cape Alarm, and it seems that the snowfields and the glaciers were washed with blood. "It's beautiful." Suddenly, the girl was beside him. The top of her head was on a level with his shoulder, and in the ruddy light, her thick roped hair glowed like newly minted sovereigns in red gold. Her voice was low and a little husky with shyness, and touched a chord of response in Nick, When she lifted her face to him, he saw how young she was.
I came to thank you, she said softly. It's the first chance I've had.
She wore baggy, borrowed men's clothing that made her look like a little girl dressing up. And her face, free of cosmetics, had that waxy, plastic glow of youth, like the polished skin of a ripe apple. Her expression was solemn, and there were traces of her recent ordeal beneath her eyes and at the corners of her mouth. Nick sensed the tension and nervousness in her.
Angel wouldn't let me come before, she said, and suddenly she smiled.
The nervousness vanished, and it was the direct, warm, unself-conscious smile of a beautiful child that has never known rejection. Nick was shocked by the strength of his sudden physical desire for her. His body moved, clenching like a fist in his groin, and he felt his heart pound furiously in the cage of his ribs. His shock turned to anger, for she looked but 14 or 15 years of age. Almost, she seemed as young as his own son, and he was shamed by the perversity of his attraction. Since the good, bright times with Chantal, he had not experienced such direct and instant involvement with a woman. At the thought of Chantal, his emotions collapsed in a disordered tangle, from which only his lust and his anger emerged clearly. He cupped the anger to him. Like a match in a high wind, it gave him strength again. Strength to thrust this aside, for he knew how vulnerable he still was, and how dangerous a course had opened before him to be led by this child woman. Suddenly he was aware that he'd swayed bodily towards the girl, and had been staring into her face for many long seconds, that she was meeting his gaze steadily, and that something was beginning to move in her eyes, like cloud shadow across the sunlit surface of a green mountain lake. Something was happening which he could not afford, could not chance. And then he realized also that the two young deck officers were watching them with undisguised curiosity, and he turned his anger on her. "Young lady," he said, "you have an absolute genius for being in the wrong place at the wrong time." And his tone was colder and more remote than even he had intended it. Before he turned away from her, he saw the moment of her disbelief turn to chagrin, and the green eyes misted slightly. He stood stiffly, staring down the foredeck, where David Allen's team was opening the forward salvage hold. Nick's anger evaporated almost at once, to be replaced by dismay. He realized clearly that he had completely alienated the girl, and he wanted to turn back to her and say something gracious that might retrieve the situation. But he could think of nothing and, instead, lifted the hand microphone to his lips and spoke to Baker of the VHF radio. "How's it going, Chief?" There were 10 seconds of delay, and Nick was very conscious of the girl's presence near him. "Their emergency generator has burned out. It'll need 2 days' work to get it running again. We'll have to take on the alternator," Beauty told him. "We're ready to give it to you," Nick told him, and then called David Allen on the foredeck. "Ready, David?" "All set." Nick began edging Warlock back towards the liner's towering stern, and at last he turned back to the girl. Unaccountably, he now wanted her approbation, so his smile was ready. But she'd already gone, taking with her that special aura of brightness. Nick's voice had a jagged edge to it as he told David Allen, "Let's do this fast and right, number one." Warlock nuzzled Adventurer's stern, the big black Yokohama fenders gentling her touch. On her foredeck, the winch whined shrilly, the lines squealing in their blocks and from the open salvage hatch, the 4-ton alternator swung out. It was mounted on a sledge for easy handling. The diesel tanks were charged, and the big motor primed and ready to start. It rose swiftly, dangling from the tall gantry, and a dozen men synchronized their efforts in those critical moments when it hung out over Warlock's bows. A nasty, freaky little swell lifted the tug and pushed her across, for the dangling burden was already putting a slight list on her, and it would have crashed into the steel side of the liner had not Nick thrown the screws into reverse thrust and given her a burst of power to hold her off. The instant the swell subsided, he closed down and slid the pitch to fine forward, pressing the cushioned bows lightly back against the adventurer's side. "He's good." David Allen watched Nicholas work. "He's better than old Mac ever was." Mackintosh, Warlock's previous skipper, had been careful and experienced, but Nicholas Berg handled the ship with flair and intuitive touch that even Mac's vast experience could never have matched. David Allen pushed the thought aside and signaled the winchman. The huge dangling machine dropped with the control of a roosting seagull onto the liner's deck. Baker's crew leapt on it immediately, releasing the winch cable and throwing out the tackle to drag it away on its sledge. Warlock drew off, and then, when Baker's crew was ready, she went in to drop another burden. This time, one of the high-speed centrifugal pumps, which would augment Golden Adventurer's own machinery, if Baker could get that functioning. It went up, out on Warlock's forward hold, followed 10 minutes later by its twin. "Both pumps secured." Baker's voice had a spark of jubilation in it. But at that moment, a shadow passed over the ship, as though a vulture wheeled above on widespread pinions. And as Nick glanced up, he saw the men on the foredeck lift their heads also. It was a single cloud, seeming no bigger than a man's fist, 1,000 or 1,500 feet above them. But it had momentarily obscured the lowering sun, before scuttling on furtively down the peaks of Cape Alarm. "There's still so much to do," Nick thought, and he opened the bridge door and stepped out onto the exposed wing. There was no movement of air, and the cold seemed less intense, although a glance at the glass confirmed that there were 30 degrees still of frost. No wind here, but high up it was beginning. "Number one," Nick snapped into the microphone. "What's going on down there? Do you think this is your daddy's yacht?" And David Allen's team leapt to the task of closing down the forward hatch and then tramped back to the double salvage holes on the long stern quarter. "I am transferring command to the stern bridge," Nick told his deck officers, and hurried back through the accommodation area to the second enclosed bridge, where every control and navigational aid was duplicated, a unique feature of salvage tug construction, where so much of the work took place on the afterdeck. This time, from the aft gantries, they lifted the loaded pallets of salvage gear onto the liner's deck. Another 8 tons of equipment went aboard Golden Adventurer. Then they pulled away, and David Allen battened down again. When he came onto the bridge, stamping and slapping his own shoulders, red-cheeked and gasping from the cold, Nick told him immediately, "Take command, David. I'm going on board." Nick could not bring himself to wait out the uncertain period while Beauty Baker put power and pumps into action. Anything mechanical was Baker's responsibility, as seamanship was strictly Nick's. But it could take many hours yet, and Nick could not remain idle that long. From high on the forward gantry, Nick looked out across that satiny, ominous sea. It was a little after midnight now, and the sun was half down behind the mountains, a two-dimensional disk of metal heated to furious crimson. The sea was somber purple, and the icebergs were sparks of brighter cherry red. From this height, he could see that the surface of the sea was crenellated, a small, regular swell spreading across it like ripples across a pond, from some disturbance far out beyond the horizon. Nick could feel the fresh movement of Warlock's hull as she rode this swell, and suddenly a puff of wind hit Nick in the face like the flit of a bat's wing, and the metallic sheen of the sea was scoured by a cat's paw of wind that scratched at the surface as it passed. He pulled the drawstring of the hood of his anorak up more tightly under his chin and stepped out onto the open boarding ladder, like a steeplejack, walking upright and balancing lightly 70 feet above Warlock's slowly rolling foredeck. He jumped down onto the Golden Adventurer's steeply canted, ice-glazed deck and saluted Warlock's bridge far below in a gesture of dismissal. "I tried to warn you, dearie," said Angel gently, as she entered the steamy galley, for with a single glance he was aware of Samantha's crestfallen air. "He tore you up, didn't he?" "What are you talking about?" She lifted her chin, and the smile was too bright and too quick. "What do you want me to do?" "You can separate that bowl of eggs," Angel told her, and stooped again over 20 pounds of red beef. With his sleeves rolled to the elbows about his thick and hairy arms, clutching a butcher's knife in a fist like that of Rocky Marciano. They worked in silence for 5 minutes before Samantha spoke again. "I only tried to thank him," and again there was a grey mist in her eyes. "He's a lower deck pig," Angel agreed. "He is not," Samantha came in hotly. "He's not a pig." "Well, then, he's a selfish, heartless bastard with jumped-up ideas." "How can you say that?" Samantha's eyes flashed now. "He is not selfish. He went into the water to get me." Then she saw the smile on Angel's lips and the mocking, quizzical expression in his eyes, and she stopped in confusion and concentrated on cracking the eggshells and slopping the contents into the mixing basin. "He's old enough to be your father," Angel needled her, and now she was really angry. A ruddy flush under the smooth gloss of her skin made the freckles shine like gold dust. "You talk the most awful crap, Angel." "God, dearie, where did you learn that language?" "Well, you're making me mad." She broke an egg with such force that it exploded down the front of her pants. "Oh, shit," she said, and stared at him defiantly. Angel tossed her a dishcloth. She wiped herself violently, and they went on working again. "How old is he?" she demanded at last. 150? "He's, 38, Angel thought for a moment. "Or 39. "Well, smart ass," she said tartly. "The ideal age is half the man's age plus 7. "You aren't 26, dearie," Angel said gently. "I will be in 2 years' time," she told him. "You really want him badly, eh? A fever of lust and desire." "That's nonsense, Angel, and you know it. I just happen to owe him a rather large debt. He saved my life. But as for wanting him, bah." She dismissed the idea with a snort of disdain and a toss of her head. "I'm glad," Angel nodded.
He's not a very nice person. You can see by those little ferrety eyes of his. He has beautiful eyes. She flared at him, and then stopped abruptly, saw the cunning of his grin, faltered, and then collapsed weakly onto the bench beside him, with a cracked egg in one hand.
Oh, Angel, you are a horrible man, and I hate you. How can you make fun of me now?
He saw how close she was to tears, and became brisk and businesslike.
First of all, you better know something about him.
And he began to tell her, giving her a waspish biography of Nicholas Berg, embellished by a vivid imagination and a wicked sense of humour, together with a quasi-feminine love of gossip, to which Samantha listened avidly, making an occasional exclamation of surprise.
His wife ran away with another man. She could be out of her mind, don't you think?
Dearie, a change is like 2 weeks at the seaside.
Or asking a question.
He owns this ship? Actually owns it? Not just master?
He owns this ship and its sister and the company. They used to call him the Golden Prince. He's a high flyer, dearie. Didn't you recognize it?
I didn't, dear.
Of course you did. You're too much woman not to. There's no more powerful aphrodisiac than success and power. Nothing like the clink of gold to get a girl's hormones revving up, is there?
That's unfair, Angel. I didn't know a thing about him. I didn't know he was rich and famous. I don't give a damn for money.
Ho, ho.
Angel shook his curls, and the diamond studs flashed in his ears. But he saw her anger flare again.
All right, dearie. I'm teasing. But what really attracts you is his strength and air of purpose. The way other men obey and follow and fear him. The air of command, of power, and with its success. I didn't...
Oh, be honest with yourself, love. It's not the fact he saved your life. It wasn't his beautiful eyes, nor the lump in his jeans.
You're crude, Angel. You're bright and beautiful, and you just can't help yourself. You're like a nubile little gazelle, all skittish and ready, and you have just spotted the herd bull. You can't help yourself, dearie. You're just a woman.
What am I going to do, Angel?
We'll make a plan, love. But one thing is certain. You're not going to trail around behind him, dressed like an escapee from a junk shop, breathing adoration and hero worship. He's doing a job. He doesn't need to trip over you every time he turns. Play hard to get.
Samantha thought about it a moment.
Angel, I don't want to play it that hard. I never get around to being God if you follow me.
Beauty Baker had the work in hand, well organized and going ahead as fast as even Nick, in his overwhelming impatience, could expect. The alternator had been manhandled through the double doors into the superstructure on B deck, and had been secured against a steel bulkhead and lashed down.
As soon as I have power, we'll drill the deck and bolt her down, he explained to Nick.
Have you got the lines in?
I'll bypass the main junction box on C deck, and I will select from the temporary box.
But you've identified the foredeck winch circuit and the pumps?
Oh, Jesus, sport. Why don't you go sail your little boat and leave me to do my work?
On the upper deck, one of Baker's gangs was already at work with the gas welding equipment. They were opening access to the ventilation shaft of the main engine room. The gas cutter hissed viciously, and red sparks showered from the steel plate of the tall dummy smokestack. The stack was merely to give the Golden Adventurer the traditional rakish lines, and now the welder cut the last few inches of steel plating. It fell away into the deep, dark cavern, leaving a roughly square opening 6 feet by 6 feet, which gave direct access into the half-flooded engine room 50 feet below. Despite Baker's advice, Nick took command here,
directing the rigging of the winch blocks and steel wire cable that would enable a cable to be taken down into the flooded engine room and out again through that long, viciously fanged gash in the ship's side. When he looked at his Rolex Oyster again, almost an hour had passed. The sun had gone, and a luminous green sky filled with marvelous pyrotechnics of the Aurora Australis turned the night eerie and mysterious.
All right, bosun, that's all we can do now. Bring your team up to the bows.
As they hurried forward along the open foredeck, the wind caught them, a single shrieking gust that had them reeling and staggering and grabbing for support. Then it was past, and the wind settled down to a nag and a whine, and pry at their clothes as Nick directed the work at the two huge anchor winches. But he heard the rising sea starting to push and stir the pack ice, make it growl and whisper menacingly. They catted the twin sea anchors, and with two men working over Adventurer's side, they secured collars of heavy chain to the crown of each anchor. Warlock would now be able to drag those anchors out, letting them bump along the bottom. But in the opposite direction to that in which they had been designed to drag, so that the pointed flukes would not be able to dig in and hold. Then, when the anchors were out to the full reach of their own chains, Warlock would drop them, the flukes would dig in and hold. This was the ground tackle, which might resist the efforts of even a force 12 wind to throw Golden Adventurer further ashore. When Baker had power on the ship, the anchor winches would be used to kedge Golden Adventurer off the bank. Nick placed much reliance on those enormously powerful winches to assist Warlock's own engines. For even as they worked, he could feel through the soles of his feet how heavily grounded the liner was. It was tense and heavy labor, for they were working with enormous weights of deadweight steel chain and shackles. The securing shackle, which held the chain collar on the anchor crown, alone weighed 300 pounds, and had to be manhandled by six men using complicated tackle. By the time they had the work finished, the wind was rising force 6 and wailing in the superstructure. The men were chilled and tired, and tempers were flashing. Nick led them back to the shelter of the main superstructure. His boots seemed to be made of lead, and his lungs pumped for the solace of cheroot smoke. And he realized irrelevantly that he had not slept now for over 50 hours, since he had fished that disturbing little girl from the water. Quickly, he pushed the thought of her aside, for it distracted him from his purpose. As he stepped over the door sill into the liner's cold but wind-protected main accommodation, he reached for his cheroot case. Then he arrested the movement and blinked with surprise as suddenly garish light blazed throughout the ship, deck lights and internal lights, so that instantly a festival air enveloped her, and from the loudspeakers on the deck above Nicholas's head wafted soft music as the broadcasting equipment switched itself in. It was the voice of Donna Summer, as limpid and ringing clear as fine-leaded crystal. The sound was utterly incongruous in this place and in these circumstances. "Power is on!" Nick let out a whoop and ran through to B-deck. Beauty Baker was standing beside his roaring alternator and hugging himself with glee. "How's that sport?" he demanded. Nick punched his shoulder. "Right on, Beauty." He wasted a few moments and a cheroot by placing one of the precious black tubes between Baker's lips and flashing his lighter. The two of them smoked for 20 seconds in close and companionable silence. "Okay," Nick ended it. pumps and winches. The two emergency portables are ready to start, and I'm on my way to check the ship's main pumps. The only thing left is to get the collision mat into place.
That is your trick, Baker told him flatly. You're not getting me into the water again, ever. I've given up bathing.
Yeah. Did you notice I'm standing upwind, Nick told him. But somebody has to go down again to pass the wire.
Why don't you send Angel?
Baker grinned evilly.
Excuse me, Cubba, I've got work to do.
He inspected the cheroot.
After we pull this dog off the ground, I hope you'll be able to afford decent gaspers.
And he was gone into the depths of the liner, leaving Nick with the one task he'd been avoiding even thinking about. Somebody had to go down into that engine room. He would call for volunteers, of course. But then, it was another of his own rules to never ask another man to do what you are afraid to do yourself. I can leave David to lay out the ground tackle, but I can't let anybody else put the collision mat in. He faced it now. He would have to go down again, into the cold and darkness and mortal danger of the flooded engine room. The ground tackle that David Allen had laid was holding Golden Adventurer handsomely, even in the aggravated swell, which was by now pouring into the open mouth of the bay, driven on by the rising wind that was inciting it to wilder abandon. David had justified Nick's confidence in the seamanlike manner in which he had taken the Golden Adventurer's twin anchors out and dropped them in a cable's length offshore, at a finely judged angle to give the best purchase and hold. Beauty Baker had installed the test run and the two big centrifugals, and it even resuscitated two of the liner's own forward pump assemblies, which had been protected by the watertight bulkhead from the sea break-in. He was ready now to throw the switch on this considerable arsenal of pumps. And he had calculated that if Nick could close that gaping rent in the hull, he would be able to pump the liner's hull dry and clean in just under 4 hours. Nick was in full immersion kit again. But this time, he had opted for a single-bottle Dredger diving set. He was off oxygen sets for life, he decided wryly. Before going down, he paused on the open deck with the diving helmet under his arm. The wind must be rising 7 now, he decided, for it was kicking off the tops of the waves in bursts of spray, and a low scudding sky of dirty grey cloud had blotted out the rising sun and the peaks of Cape Alarm. It was a cold, dark dawn, with the promise of a wilder day to follow. Nick took one glance across at Warlock. David Allen was holding her nicely in position, and his own team was ready, grouped around that ugly black, freshly burned opening in Adventurer's stack. He lifted the helmet onto his head, and while his helpers closed the fastenings and screwed down the hose connections, he checked the radio. Warlock, do you read me? Allen's voice came back immediately, acknowledging and confirming his readiness. Then he went on, the glass just went through the floor, Skipper. She's 996 and going down. Winds force 6, rising 7 and backing. It looks like we are fair in the dangerous quadrant of whatever is coming. Thank you, David, Nick replied. You warm my heart. He stepped forward, and they helped him into the canvas bosun's chair. Nick checked the tackle and rigging, that once more for luck check, and then he nodded. The interior of the engine room was no longer dark, for Baker had rigged floodlights high above in the ventilation shaft, but the water was black with engine oil, and as Nick was lowered slowly down, with legs dangling from the bosun's chair. It surged furiously back and across, like some panic-stricken monster trying to break out of its steel cage. The wind-driven swell was crashing into Golden Adventurer's side and boiling in through the opening, setting up its own wave action, forming its own currents and eddies, which broke and leaped angrily against the steel bulkheads.
"Slower!" Nick spoke into the microphone. "Stop!"
Her downward progress was halted 10 feet above the starboard main engine block. But the confined surge of water broke over the engine as though it were a coral reef, covering it entirely at one instant and then sucking back and exposing it again at the next. The rush of water could throw a man against that machinery with force enough to break every bone in his body. And Nick hung above it and studied the purchases for his blocks. "Send down the main block," he ordered. And the huge steel block came down out of the shadows and dangled in the floodlights. "Stop," Nick began directing the block into position. "Down 2 feet. Stop." Now waist-deep in the oily, churning water, he struggled to drive the shackle pin and secure the block to one of the main frames of the hull. Every few minutes, a stronger surge would hurl the water over his head, forcing him to cling helplessly until it relinquished its grip and his visor cleared sufficiently to allow him to continue his task. He had to pull out and rest after 40 minutes of it. He sat as close as he could to the heat exchangers of the running diesel engine of the alternator, taking warmth from them and drinking Angel's strong, sweet thermos coffee. He felt like a fighter between rounds, his body aching, every muscle strained and chilled by the efforts of fighting that filthy, churned emulsion of sea water and oil, his flanks and ribs bruised from harsh contact with the submerged machinery. But after 20 minutes, he stood up again. "Let's go," he said, and resettled the helmet. The hiatus had given him a chance to replan the operation, thinking his way around the problems he had found down there. Now the work seemed to fall more readily into place, though he had lost all sense of time alone in the infernal, resounding cavern of steel, and he was not sure of the hour or the phase of the day, when at last he was ready to carry the messenger out through the gap. "Send it down," he ordered into his headset, and the reel of light line came down, swinging and circling under the glaring floodlights to the ship's motion and throwing grotesque shadows into the far corners of the engine room. The line was a finely plaited Dacron, with enormous strength and elasticity in relation to its thinness and lightness. One end was secured on the deck high above, and Nick threaded it into the sheave blocks carefully so that it was free to run. Then he clamped the reel of line onto his belt, riding it on his hip, where it could be protected from snagging when he made the passage of the gap. He realized then how close to final exhaustion he was, and he considered breaking off the work to rest again, but the heightened action of the sea into the hull warned him against further delay. An hour from now, the task might be impossible. He had to go. And he reached for the reserve of strength and purpose deep inside himself, surprised to find that he was still there, for the icy chill of the water seemed to have penetrated his suit and entered his soul, dulling every sense and turning his very bones brittle and heavy. It must be day outside, he realized, for light came through the gash of steel, pale light, further obscured by the filthy muck of mixed oil and water contained in the hull. He clung to one of the engine room stringers, his head 7 feet from the opening, breathing in the slow, even rhythm of the experienced scuba diver, feeling the ebb and flow through the hull, and trying to find some pattern in the action of the water. But it seemed entirely random, a hissing, bubbling ingestion, followed by 3 or 4 irregular and weak inflows. Then 3 vicious exhalations of such power that they would have windmilled a swimming man end over end into those daggers of splayed steel. He had to choose and ride a middling-sized swell, strong enough to take him through smoothly, without the dangerous power and turbulence of those viciously large swells. "I'm ready to go now, David," he said into his helmet. "Confirm that the work boat is standing by for the pickup outside the hull." "We're all ready." David Allen's voice was tense and sharp. "Here we go," said Nick. This was his wave now. There was no point in waiting longer. He checked the reel on his belt, ensuring that the line was free to run, and watched the gash suck in clean green water, filled with tiny bright bubbles, little diamond chips that flew past his head to warn him of the lethal speed and power of that flood. The inflow slowed and stopped as the hull filled to capacity, building up great pressures of air and water. And then the flow reversed abruptly as the swell on the far side subsided and trapped water began to rush out again. Nick released his grip on the stringer, and instantly the water caught him. There was no question of being able to swim in that mill race. All he could hope for was to keep his arms at his sides and his legs straight together to give himself a smoother profile and to steer with his fins. The accelerating speed appalled him as he was flung headfirst at the murderous steel mouth. He could feel the nylon line streaming out against his leg, the reel of his belt racing as though a giant marlin had struck and hooked upon the other end. The rush of his progress seemed to leave his guts behind him, as though he rode a fairground roller coaster. And then a flick of the current turned him. He felt himself beginning to roll, and he fought wildly for control, just as he hit. He hit with a numbing shock, so his vision starred in flashing color and light. The shock was in his shoulders and left arm, and he thought it might have been severed by that razor steel. Then he was swirling end over end, completely disorientated, so that he did not know which direction was up. He did not know if he was still inside Golden Adventurer's hull. The nylon line was wrapping itself around his throat and chest, around the precious air tubes, and cutting off his air supply, like a stillborn infant strangled by its own umbilical cord. Again he hit something, this time with the back of his head, and only the cushioning of his helmet saved his skull from cracking. He flung out his arms and found the rough, irregular shape of ice above him. Terror wrapped him again, and he screamed soundlessly into his mask. But suddenly he broke out into light and air, into the loose scum of slush and rotten ice mixed with bigger, harder chunks, one of which had hit him. Above him towered the endless steel cliff of the liner's side, and beyond that the low, bruised wind sky. And as he struggled to disentangle himself from the coils of nylon, he realized 2 things. The first was that both his arms were still attached to his body, and still functioning. And the second was that Warlock's workboat was only 20 feet away, and butting itself busily through the brash of rotten, broken ice towards him. The collision mat looked like a 5-ton Airedale Terrier curled up to sleep in the bows of the workboat, just as shaggy and shapeless, and of the same wiry, furry brown color. Nick had shed his helmet and pulled an Arctic cloak and hood over his bare head and suited torso. He was balanced in the stern of the workboat as she plunged and rolled and porpoised in the big swells. Chunks of ice cracked against her hull, knocking loose chips off her paintwork, but she was steel-hulled, wide and sea-kindly. The helmsman knew his job, working her with calm efficiency to Nick's hand signals, bringing her in close through the brash ice under the tall sheer of Golden Adventurer's stern. The thin, white nylon line was the only physical contact with the men on the liner's towering stack of decks, the messenger which would carry heavier tackle. However, it was vulnerable to any jagged piece of pancake ice or the fangs of that voracious underwater steel jaw. Nick paid out the line through his own numbed hands, feeling for the slightest check or jerk, which would mean a snag and a break-off. With hand signals, he kept the workboat positioned so that the line ran cleanly into the pierced hull, around the sheave blocks he had placed with such heart-breaking labor in the engine room. From there, up the tall ventilation shaft, out of the burned square opening in the stack, and around the winch, beside which Beauty Baker was supervising the recovery of the messenger. The gusts tore at Nick's head, so they had to crouch to shield the small two-way radio on his chest, and Baker's voice was tinny and thin in the buffeting boom of wind. "Line running free." "Right. We are running the wire now," Nick told him. The second line was as thick as a man's index finger, and it was of the finest Scandinavian steel cable. Nick checked the connection between nylon and steel cable himself. The nylon messenger was strong enough to carry the weight of steel, but the connection was the weakest point. He nodded to the crew and let it go over the side. The white nylon disappeared into the cold green water, and now the black steel cable ran out slowly from the revolving drum. Nick felt the check as the connection hit the sheave block in the engine room. He felt his heart jump. If it caught now, they would lose it all. No man could penetrate that hull again. The sea was now too vicious. They would lose the tackle, and they would lose Golden Adventurer. She would break up in the seas that were coming. "Please, God, let it run," Nick whispered in the boom, and the burst of the sea and the wind. The drum halted, made a half turn, and jammed. Somewhere down there, the cable had snagged, and Nick signaled to the helmsman to take the workboat in closer, to change the angle of the line into the hull. He could almost feel the strain along his nerves as the winch took up the pull, and he could imagine the fibers of the nylon messenger stretching and creaking. "Let it run. Let it run," prayed Nick. Then suddenly, he saw the drum began to revolve again, the cable feeding out smoothly and streaming down into the sea. Nick felt lightheaded, almost dizzy with relief, as he heard Baker's voice over the VHF, strident with triumph. "Wire secured!" "Stand by," Nick told him. "We are connecting the 2-inch wire now." Again, the whole laborious, touchy, nerve-scouring process as the massive 2-inch steel cable was drawn out by its thinner, weaker forerunner. And it was a further 40 vital minutes, with the wind and sea rising every moment, before Baker shouted, "Main cable secured. We are ready to haul." "Negative," Nick told him urgently. "Take the strain and hold." If the collision mat in the bows hooked and held on the workboat's gunwale, Baker would pull the bows under and swamp her. Nick signaled to his crew, and the five of them shambled up into the bows, bulky and clumsy in their electric yellow oilskins and work boots. With hand signals, Nick positioned them around the shaggy, head-high pile of the collision mat before he signaled to the helmsman to throw the gear in reverse and pull back from Golden Adventurer's side. The mass of unraveled oakum quivered and shook as the 2-inch cable came up taut, and they struggled to heave the whole untidy mass overboard. There was nearly 5 tons of it, and the weight would have been impossible to handle were it not for the reverse pull of the workboat against the cable. Slowly, they heaved the mat forward and outward, and the workboat took on a dangerous list under the transfer of weight. She was down at the bows, and canting at an angle of 20 degrees, the diesel motor screaming angrily, and her single propeller threshing frantically, trying to pull her out from under her cumbersome burden. The mat slid forward another foot, and snagged on the gunwale. The sea water slopped inboard, ankle deep around their rubber boots, as they strained and heaved at the reluctant mass of coarse fiber. Some instinct of danger made Nick look up and out to sea. Warlock was lying a quarter of a mile further out in the bay, at the edge of the ice and beyond her. Nick saw the rearing shape of a big wave alter the line of the horizon. It was merely a forerunner of the truly big waves that the storm was running before her, like hounds before the hunter. But it was big enough to make Warlock throw up her stern sharply, and even then the sea creamed over the tug's bows and streamed from her scuppers. It would hit the exposed and hampered workboat in 25 seconds. It would hit her broadside while her bows were held down and anchored by mat and cable. When she swamped, the 5 men who made up her crew would die within minutes, pulled down by their bulky clothing, frozen by the icy green waters. "Beauty!" Nick's voice was a scream in the microphone. "Heave-ho! Pull, damn you! Pull!" Almost instantly, the cable began to run, drawn in by the powerful winch on Golden Adventurer's deck. The strain pulled the workboat down sharply, and water cascaded over her gunwale. Nick seized one of the oaken oars and thrust it under the mat at the point where it had snagged, and using it as a lever, he threw all his weight upon it. "Lend a hand!" he yelled at the man beside him, and he strained until he felt his vision darkening and the fibers of his back muscles creaking and popping. The workboat was swamping. They were almost knee-deep now, and the wave raced down on them. It came with a great silent rush of irresistible power, lifting the mass of broken ice and tossing it carelessly aside without a check. Suddenly, the snag cleared, and the whole lumpy, massive weight of oakum slid overboard. The workboat bounded away, relieved of her intolerable burden, and Nick windmilled frantically with both arms to get the helmsman to bring her bows round to the wave. They went up the wave with a gut-swooping rush that threw them down onto the floorboards of the half-flooded workboat, and then crashed over the crest. Beyond them, the waves slogged into Golden Adventurer's stern and shot up it with an explosion of white and furious water that turned to white-driven spray in the wind. The helmsman already had the workboat pushing heavily through the pack ice back towards the waiting Warlock. "Stop!" Nick signaled him. "Back up!" Already he was struggling out of his hood and oilskins as he staggered back to the stern. He shouted in the helmsman's face, "I'm going down to check!" And he saw the disbelieving, almost pleading expression on the man's face. He wanted to get out of there now, back to the safety of Warlock. But relentlessly, Nick resettled the diving helmet and connected his air hose. The collision mat was floating hard against Golden Adventurer's side, buoyant with trapped air among the mass of wiry fiber. Nick positioned himself beneath it, 20 feet from the maelstrom created by the gashed steel. It took him only a few seconds to ensure that the cable was free, and he blessed Beauty Baker silently for stopping the winch immediately it had pulled the mat free of the workboat. Now he could direct the final task. "She's looking good," he told Baker, "but take her up slowly. 50 feet a minute on the winch." 50 feet it is," Baker confirmed, and slowly the bobbing mat was drawn down below the surface. "Good. Keep it at that." It was like pressing a field dressing into an open, bleeding wound. The outside pressure of water drove it deep into the gash, while from the inside, the 2-inched cable plugged it deeper into place. The wound was staunched almost instantly, and Nick finned down and swam carefully over it. The deadly suck and blow of high pressure through the gap was killed now, and he detected only the lightest movement of water around the edges of the mat. But the oakum fibers would swell now they were submerged, and within hours the plug would be watertight. "It's done," said Nick into his microphone. "Hold a 20-ton pull on the cable, and you can start your pumps and suck the bitch clean." It was a measure of his stress and relief and fatigue that Nick called that beautiful ship a bitch, and he regretted the word as it was spoken. Nick craved sleep. Every nerve, every muscle shrieked for surcease. And in his bathroom mirror, his eyes were inflamed, angry with salt and wind and cold. The smears of exhaustion that underlined them were as lurid as the fresh bruises and abrasions that covered his shoulders and thighs and ribs. His hands shook in a mild palsy with the need for rest, and his legs could hardly carry him as he forced himself back to Warlock's navigation bridge. "Congratulations, sir," said David Allen, and his admiration was transparent. "How's the glass, David?" Nick asked, trying to keep the weariness from showing. 994 and dropping, sir." Nick looked across at Golden Adventurer. Below that dingy low sky, she stood like a pier, unmoved by the big swells that marched on her in endless ranks. And she shrugged aside each burst of spray, harder ground and heavy with the water in her womb. However, that water was being flung from her in solid white sheets. Baker's big centrifugals were running at full power, and from both her port and starboard quarters, the water poured. It looked as though the floodgates had been opened on a concrete dam. So powerful was the rush of expelled water. The oil and diesel mixed with that discharge formed a sullen, iridescent slick around her, sullying the ice and the pebble beach on which she lay. The wind caught the jets from the pump outlets and tore them away in glistening plumes, like great ostrich feathers of spray. "Chief," Nick called the ship, "what's your discharge rate?" "We're moving nigh on 500,000 gallons an hour." "Call me as soon as she alters her trim," he said, and then glanced up at the point of the anemometer above the control panel. The wind force was riding 8 now, but he had to blink his stinging, swollen eyes to read the scale. "David," he said, and he could hear the hoarseness in his voice, the flat, dead tone. "It'll be 4 hours before she'll be light enough to make an attempt to haul her off. But I want you to put the main towing cable on board her and make fast, so I'll be ready when she is. Sir, use a rocket line," said Nick, and then stood dumbly, trying to think of the other orders he must give, but his brain was blank. "Are you all right, sir?" David asked with quick concern, and immediately Nick felt the prick of annoyance. He had never wanted sympathy in his life, and he found his voice again. But he stopped the sharp words that came so quickly to his lips. "You know what to do, David. I won't give you any other advice." He turned like a drunkard towards his quarters. "Call me when you've done it. Or if Baker reports alteration of trim, or if anything else changes, anything. Anything at all, you understand?" He made it to the cabin before his knees buckled, and he dropped his teddy robe as he toppled backwards onto his bunk. At 60 degrees south latitude, there runs the only sea lane that circumnavigates the entire globe, unbroken by any landmass. This wide girdle of open water runs south of Cape Horn and Australasia and the Cape of Good Hope, and it has the fearsome reputation of breeding the wildest weather on Earth. It is the meeting ground of two vast air masses, the cold, slumping Antarctic air, and the warmer, more buoyant airs of the subtropics. They are flung together by the centrifugal forces generated by the Earth as it revolves on its own axis, and their movement is further complicated by the enormous torque of the Coriolis force. If they strike each other, the opposing air masses split into smaller fragments that retain their individual characteristics. They begin to revolve upon themselves, gigantic whirlpools of tortured air. And as they advance, so they gain in strength and power and velocity. The high-pressure system, which had brought that ominously calm and silken weather to Cape Alarm, had bounced the pressure right up to 1,035 millibars, while the Great Depression, which pursued it so closely and swiftly, had a center pressure as low as 985 millibars. Such sharp contrast meant that the winds along the pressure gradient were ferocious. The depression itself was almost 1,500 miles across its circumference, and it reached up to the high troposphere, 30,000 feet above the level of the sea. The mighty winds it contained reached right off the maximum of the Beaufort scale of force 12, gusting 120 miles an hour and more. They roared unfettered upon a terrible sea, unchecked by the bulwark of any landmass. Nothing in their path but the sudden, jagged barrier of Cape Alarm. While Nicholas Berg slept the death-like sleep of utter exhaustion, and Beauty Baker tended his machines, driving them to their limits in an effort to pump Golden Adventurer free of her burden of salt water, the storm rushed down upon them. When her knock was unanswered, Samantha stood uncertainly, balancing the heavy tray against Warlock's extravagant action as she rode the rising swells at the entrance to the bay. Her uncertainty lasted not more than 3 seconds, for she was a lady given to swift decision. She tried the door latch, and when it turned, she pushed it open slowly enough to warn anybody on the far side, and stepped into the captain's day cabin. He ordered food, she justified her intrusion, and closed the door behind her, glancing swiftly around the empty cabin. It had been furnished in the high style of the old White Star liners. Real rosewood panelling, and the couch and chairs were in rich brown calf hide, polished and buttoned, while the deck was carpeted in thick, shaggy wool, the colour of tropical forest leaves.
Samantha placed the tray on the table that ran below the starboard portholes, and she called softly. There was no reply, and she stepped to the open doorway into the night cabin. A white terry robe lay in a heap in the center of the deck, and she thought for one disturbing moment that the body on the bed was naked. But then she saw he wore a thin pair of white silk boxer shorts. "Captain Berg," she called again, but softly enough not to disturb him, and with a completely feminine gesture, picked up the robe from the floor, folded it, and dropped it over a chair, moving forward at the same time until she stood beside his bunk. She felt a quick flare of concern when she saw the bruises which stood out so vividly on the smooth, pale skin. And concern turned to dismay when she realized how he lay like a dead man, his legs trailing over the edge of the bunk and his body twisted awkwardly, one arm thrown back over his shoulder and his head lolling from side to side as Warlock rolled. She reached out quickly and touched his cheek, experiencing a lift of real relief as she felt the warmth of his flesh and saw his eyelids quiver at her touch. Gently, she lifted his legs, and he rolled easily onto his side, exposing the sickening abrasion that wrapped itself angrily across his back and shoulder. She touched it with a light, exploring fingertip, and knew that it needed attention, but she sensed that rest was what he needed more. She stood back and for long seconds gave herself over to the pleasure of looking at him. His body was fined down. He carried no fat on his belly or flanks. Clearly, she could see the rack of his ribs below the skin, and the muscles of his arms and legs were smooth but well-defined. A body that had been cared for and honed by hard exercise. Yet, there was a certain denseness to it, that thickening of shoulder and neck, and the distinctive hair patterns of the mature man. It might not have the grace and delicacy of the boy she had known, yet it was more powerful than that of even the strongest of the young men who had until then filled her world. She thought of one of them whom she had believed she loved. They had spent 2 months in Tahiti together on the same field expedition. She had surfed with him, danced and drunk wine, worked and slept 60 consecutive days and nights with him. In the same period, they become engaged to marry, and had argued and parted, with surprisingly little regret on her part. But he'd had the most beautiful tanned and sculptured body she'd ever known. Now, looking at the sleeping figure on the bunk, she knew that even he would have not been able to match this man in physical determination and strength. Angel had been right. It was the power that attracted her so strongly, the powerful, rangy body, with the dark, coarse hair covering his chest and exploding in flak bursts in his armpits. This, together with the power of his presence.